Right now, though, we do need to welcome into the studio Dr. Sam Jones from My Local Vet. Hello.
Good morning, Sally.
Now, Sam comes in every 6 weeks or so to help you out with your pet problems. And you know those numbers. If you have a question about your pet, now is the time to call 1-300-222-612. Or send us a text, 0467-922-612. Sam, we've already got one text in from Joe from Banyo. Joe says, we have a male Siamese cat, de-sexed. That's good, Joe. His litter box has a high wall. It's cleaned out every day. He started doing the droppings outside of the box on the concrete floor. Any explanation or advice has never been allowed outside for his safety and safety of wildlife.
It's an interesting one that Joey mentions that the litter box has high walls, because I wonder if her cat, you know, if he's a bit older and he might be starting to develop some arthritis, whether climbing over the high side of a litter box is just too much of a challenge. That's one possibility. We don't know his age, but certainly cats can develop an aversion to using kitty litter that they previously have used for years. And sometimes that can be associated with something like, let's say if you have a kitty litter set up in the laundry, for example.
Yeah.
And you've got
the dryer.
The washing machine.
Yeah.
But it suddenly just goes off into spin cycle, and or the cat's in the middle of a poo and it just completely freaks it out, right? So that can be one reason why a cat's like, oh, I don't really want to go back here again. I'm not feeling safe. And
crazy. You know, I'd never even thought of that. Mm.
Yeah, so it's something to consider. You know, we don't know exactly where this little guy's litter box is. But I can tell you, it's just some general advice. Before I get onto that, yes, some cats, when they get stressed, if there's a change in the household, that can cause, you know, inappropriate urination or defecation.
Okay.
By inappropriate, we basically just mean outside the litter box.
Yeah.
That stress can be subtle, or it can be fairly obvious. You know, it could be a renovation going on, lots of banging, new people in the house, or it could be a new cat in the neighbourhood that, you know, your cat can just see through the window. Even if your cat is not an outdoor cat, that can cause enough stress for a cat to start to urinate or defecate outside of the litter box. So things to be aware of. Is there anything in the environment that could be causing stress? And just as a sort of a general guideline, we recommend having multiple litter boxes, even if you've just got one cat.
Yes.
To give them options of substrate, meaning, you know, the stuff that you put into that litter box should be different between those two, so that you can kind of get a sense of what they do prefer to use.
Mm-hmm.
So, you might get the little rolled up bits of newspaper, or you might use crystals or something like that. You can split them up and test them out. And you should have one with a hood and one without to try and get a sense of which sort of setup your cat prefers.
Now, yes,
one can be forgiven for thinking that the majority of cats would prefer the extra privacy of having a hood. But in clinical studies, in trials, they found that majority of cats prefer not to have a cover.
Is it exhibitionism?
That might be a bit extreme. I don't know. You'd have to ask a cat. but that's a very funny idea. So there's some considerations. Multiple kitty litters and trying out different substrates and putting those kitty litters in different areas of the house.
And how many kitty litters per cat should we have?
Two. Two. And if you want to go...
Two per cat?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you want to be able to give them lots of options.
I have a big house.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're into cats, you know.
Well, sure. Absolutely. Anything for the cats.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, just ask the cats. They'll tell you what they need.
1-300-222-612 if you have a question for Dr. Sam Jones from My Local Vet this morning. Or send us a text 0467-922-612. Susan has texted in saying, I've got a miniature fox terrier who has a problem called catching flies. With catching flies? Catching flies. Does that make sense?
Well, there is a syndrome called flycatcher.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Neurological abnormality. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's what she's got. Okay. I can't see the text myself.
Oh, sorry.
Is there any more information?
No, that's it.
Just that she's got it.
Yeah. So what is it?
Well, it's probably categorized in the same group as things like it's an obsessive compulsive type of behavior. And so it's a neurological issue, behavioral neurological issue. And I'd have to read up on, okay, you know, what's the underlying causes that can precipitate this type of behaviour. I don't know exactly. But I think I have seen a Bull Terrier with it, but it was just years ago, so I yes. can't remember the specifics. But they, you know, are essentially sort of biting at the air. Ah. And it's as if they're seeing flies and trying to catch them.
Okay.
So it's pretty, and you know, these things can really impact animals' quality of life.
Yeah, totally.
And so, you know, often they'll be medicated in order to try to, you know, dull down the stimulus that's causing that behaviour.
Because, yeah.
I mean, I've seen, again, similar sort of behaviours, tail chasing, which you might think, oh, that's innocent enough and that's okay. But
yeah.
But some dogs will chase their tail until their paws bleed. You know, like this is, really, really severe sort of stereotypic, we call it stereotypies, where, you know, the animals in the zoo, when they're pacing up and down and that sort of thing. So that's a similar sort of behaviour. But these guys, this obsessive kind of tail chasing, and they can wear the pads off their paws. It's very sad.
Susan says that she has, it's a miniature fox terrier. Are there specific breeds which are more susceptible to those things?
There will be. There will be breeds, you know, susceptibility.
Yeah.
Because there'll be a genetic component to it, no doubt. Mm. Usually both genetic and environmental. And, okay. you know, often these animals can have the genes, and given the right environment, those genes may not be expressed. But then given an environment, you know, that does kind of cause those genes to be expressed, well, then they can show that disease.
We just answered that from Susan. Joe in Banyo texted in saying the cat's only five, the box is in garage, but the stepdad was in hospital for a month. So that
interesting.
Could be why. Yeah, 1-300-222-612 if you have a question about your pet for Dr. Sam Jones. Dick is on the Sunshine Coast, got chihuahua problems.
Yes, we have. We had this little chihuahua, and it was an outside dog before we got him in. Now he's an inside dog, and we're having trouble toilet training him. When he goes outside, we give him a treat, and yes, he loves that. But every now and again, he still defecates inside the house.
Yeah. Look, that's going to be a common issue, Dick, when we take a dog that's used to living outdoors and doing, you know, toileting whenever and wherever it wants to then being kind of restricted, you know, indoors. How old's the little guy?
Three.
He's three. Yeah. So, you know, the way I would approach this is to try to, and this is a bit tricky in a three-year-old dog, but try to anticipate when we think he might need the toilet. Now, the obvious one is first thing in the morning, right? And so you take him outside, and you might have to sort of stand there for a good 10 minutes before anything happens. You know, he's going to get out and about. He's going to sniff around and explore the environment. And then he might get a bit bored and decide, you know what, I'm ready to do a poo. And then once he's doing that, then obviously do what you're currently doing, which is give him a treat and give him some praise. He'll appreciate that. And then if you do catch him in the act when he's indoors, and by no means am I suggesting that he would do this maliciously, obviously he doesn't know any different, you want to just sort of try to interrupt the behaviour as quickly as you can. So I typically, with my dog when he was a puppy at least, would sort of go up like that just to catch his attention, quickly scoop him up and take him out exactly where you want him to do his business. And in terms of where you put him for that, I mean, I wish I'd been a bit more strategic back in the day when my dog Dibby was a puppy, because I would have been putting him in the garden, you know, where the leaf litter is, rather than on the grass, because that would make sense, and then it can just sort of biodegrade and whatnot. So you can actually train them to go to the toilet in a specific area of the yard as well, which obviously will save you grass in terms of dogs urinating on your grass and things. Now, the other thing I'm just going to tell you, Dick, which I think will be super helpful, will be crate training. Get on the internet, have a look at that. Essentially, what it is setting up a environment in a crate. Now, the crate typically is sort of a wire mesh. They can see through the walls of the crate, and it can be in a place where you know, an area of the house where you guys are a lot of the time. Let's say it's the living room or something, so that they feel, you know, part of the household. And that crate, they go into the crate every night. Ideally, they go in voluntarily, i.e., you might throw a treat in there and then he'll scoot in after it and you close the door behind him, or you feed him his dinner in there and then you close the door, however you want to do it. But that's where he sleeps overnight. And if he's in this crate, and if it's the appropriate size for his body, which would be relatively small for a chihuahua, then he's much less likely to toilet overnight and then you know you've got a full bladder and possibly a poo ready to go in the morning when you pick him up and take him outside into the yard.
Right, because it's mainly at night that this happens.
Okay, well, there's your answer. But just remember, that crate absolutely can't be a place of punishment or of... It needs to be a sanctuary in which he loves to go into, so he'll have some toys in the crate. You know, obviously, his bedding will be up one end, water and food down the other end, and every now and then you might want to hide some little treats in there so that the crate becomes this wonderland for him to spend time in.
Good luck. Good luck with that, Dick. Thank you so much for your call. 1-300-222-612 if you have a question for Dr. Sam Jones. Now, I think if you're thinking, oh, I don't know if I'm going to call now, because we're only going to have Sam for a couple more minutes, and then it will be, I think you've got one more appearance before the end of the year.
Have I? I probably do. I'm living one day at a time here.
Hey, look, you do you, Sam. 1-300-222-612 if you've got a question for Sam, or send us a text 0467-922-612. Now, the last time you were on, you got a text and you wanted to address it today because it is about the cost of veterinary medication.
Yeah, I thought this was a really good one. Now, it's John from Tolga, and he wrote in saying, hello, vets, my three-year-old bull terrier has skin issues and chronic pododermatitis. That is, for those listeners who aren't familiar, inflammation of the pores, right? Podo. Anyway, now, he mentioned a bunch of medications, which included some antibiotics, some other things, and he said, look, you know, everything's over $100. Why is medication so expensive from a veterinarian? And there's a few forces, you know, at play here. First of all, where do we get our reference point from? Well, typically we get it from buying human medication, and we have to remember that a lot of the human medication is subsidised by the government, by the PBS, Pharmaceutical Benefit Scheme, right? So we're not typically paying full price for our medication. So we can't really use that as a reference point. But the other thing I think that's at play here, and I mean, I can't talk about the cost of actually manufacturing these drugs because I don't have the first idea how much it costs to make them. But certainly, you know, when you're looking at veterinary practices that are buying drugs, we don't have anywhere near, or at least the independent veterinary practices don't have anywhere near the buying power of something like Chemist Warehouse, for example, like these huge, big, you know, chemists. So we're just not able to buy the medications in anywhere near as cheaply as what they might be able to. And so then we're not able to pass on, you know, those reduced prices. So they're just a couple of things that influence the cost of veterinary medication. And I guess also, you know, the manufacturing of veterinary medication maybe to some extent lags behind human, and so maybe there's a something at play there as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that people sort of sometimes don't factor in when they get a pet, is that it's expensive to take them to the vet.
Oh, look, it's expensive, full stop. You know, when you factor in insurance, and this is, I say this to my clients all the time, look, in my opinion, getting insurance is a very valuable thing, even if it's for the first couple of years. I mean, that's when you see a lot of the puppy, you know, they do silly things, right? They've got very sensitive stomachs. So they eat silly stuff in the backyard. They run out onto the road, all this sort of stuff. And it's very expensive to treat them. And so insurance is really great. And I think once you see the benefit of that in the first couple of years of a dog's life, then you tend to stick with it for life, you know. And it just takes the financial stress out of it.
Lisa is in Roma. Got a question about raw chicken necks. Hello, Lisa.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Yeah, good. What's your question for Sam?
I just wondered if it was safe to give your dogs raw chicken necks. Like, we've got a mixed breed greyhound, Arab cross. She's beautiful, or Ridgeback, sorry. She only gets one in the morning and one in the evening with the rest of her food. But a lady at the shops this morning was saying that she was advised by her vet that they shouldn't have them due to the way chickens are injected with the steroids through the neck or something.
That's an interesting question, Lisa. Well, put it this way. When we went through as part of our training as veterinarians, we have to go out and, you know, witness places like, you know, abattoirs and things like that. And also, you know, these large farms, animal production facilities, right? And I was never aware that these animals were being injected in the neck with steroids. Now, it might change state to state, might change facility to facility. Certainly there are, I think, some growth influencing things in feed often for food-producing animals. Now, but just some general advice about chicken necks, things to be aware of. You know, veterinarians used to say that bones are really great for cleaning a dog's teeth. Yep. Now, and that may have been the case some years ago when chickens were ultimately, they were more fully developed before they were slaughtered. Now, these days, the chickens, the broilers, the animals that are grown for their meat, they are, they often grow so quickly that the bones actually aren't that well mineralised. And I don't know that they actually offer that much benefit in terms of cleaning the teeth. Right?
No.
Now, and you also technically have the risk of, especially if you're feeding raw chicken bones, of, you know, bacterial problems like salmonella, like campylobacter. Having said that, you know, I've had conversations with many clients that feed raw food to their dog, and I don't see, anecdotally, I don't see that many cases of salmonellosis or campylobacter, but it is technically a possibility. And not to mention the fact that these days, you know, the best advice is that there are lots of really better alternatives for cleaning a dog's teeth than bones. Because the other thing is that the bigger bones, I mean, not the chicken necks, obviously, but these really, you know, the large femurs and thing of a cow, if you feed the shaft of those large bones to a dog, they can fracture the dog's teeth. And that's a major problem because once that tooth is fractured, if the pulp cavity of the tooth is exposed and you don't catch it within 24 hours, that tooth needs to come out because it will get infected. So, you know, ultimately the way to look after your dog's teeth is brushing and annual dentistry with your veterinarian. And then the chicken necks, you know, it's up to you whether you do it or not, but I wouldn't be doing it for the dog's teeth, put it that way.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks very much for your advice.
Thank you, Lisa.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Kelly has texted in with a question I think a lot of people are going to perhaps relate to. Hello, our neighbours have a five-month small oodle dog that has bad separation anxiety issues and barks at every single thing and absolutely nothing too. Any advice as a neighbour? It's driving me crazy.
I quite like these questions. They used to stress me out a little bit when we had dogs because the thing is that dogs bark for so many different reasons.
Yes.
You know, and it's all contextual. But the reason I like this question is because there is one solid bit of advice you can give to every person that's got a dog that barks, and that is keep those dogs tired, right? You want to exercise those dogs so that barking is kind of like a real effort for them, right? So, you know, you want to, first and foremost, make sure that it's a little five-month-old dog. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's what she said. You want to keep that dog well and truly fatigued, you know, lots of exercise. And and then I think try to identify, I mean, she said that, you know, pretty much everything the little dog is barking at. So it's a bit tricky to say, okay, well, it's this particular thing or it's that particular thing. But in general, when we're trying to train a dog out of a behaviour, the first principle is we try to avoid the stimulus in the first place because the more times they actually do the behaviour, the more learned it becomes. So we want to try and, you know, not put them in the position where they're inclined to bark. Now, that might be just impossible in this case. I don't know. And you can try to divert their training by using some basic commands, and you start at home where there's no other stimulus, no reason for the dog to bark, and that might be just your really basic come, sit, stay.
So, yes.
You know, and once they've got that, and obviously involve some treats, so you might say, you know, come and get the dog to sit, good girl, then give her a treat, and then stay, using the palm of your hand is a good way to do that. And then when you're out and about, let's say, I don't know, you're on a walk or something and you can see, oh, there's a dog coming down the other side of the road. I know she's going to start barking. That is when you'd go into that routine and keep your puppy's focus in that routine whilst the other dog goes past and you've won, right?
Yeah. But so Kelly's saying, though, this is her neighbour's dog going nuts. And, you know, obviously that happens in a lot of cases.
How do you stop the neighbours?
Yeah, does she just
not go out
into her backyard? I mean, and it's a thing though. Like people get these dogs and you're right, don't tire them out. And this dog's got bad separation anxiety, so it's barking all day when their owners go to work. Mm. So, I mean,
how do you train other people's kids?
exactly. Someone who has a dog that has bad separation anxiety. Yeah, it could be listening. So, I mean, people are leaving their dogs at home while they go to work from 9 to 5.
What do you do in that situation? Mm. Yeah, I mean, like ideally you would obviously exercise them, like I said, in the first place, so that they want to spend the majority of the time just kind of sleeping, right? They're not going to sleep for 8 hours. So they're going to get up and about and want to do something. And then you'd have a series of toys and puzzles and things for them to engage with. And that might be frozen sardines, you know, in a frozen block of ice, like in an ice cream container, something that they're going to gnaw at for an hour or so. Or it might be a Kong, like a little device that you can put some kibble into and they push it around the backyard. But, you know, ultimately they're going to need some stimulation. And look, there are some dogs that we medicate for separation anxiety.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because they need it, you know. It's otherwise becomes a bit of a welfare issue. So provided those clients are doing the best they can to exercise the dog and keep the dog stimulated, sometimes some of these dogs just will benefit from medication.
Should Kelly just make friends with the neighbours and find out the dog's name and maybe give it a little treat over the fence?
Yeah, potentially. I think if you gave it a treat while it was barking, that's surely going to reinforce the behaviour.
Damn it.
Or a little doggy door between the fences and she can come next door.
Oh, yeah, she can come and visit.
Depends how much she loves the dog,
Kelly. Gee, I hope this is helpful for you, Kelly. I absolutely get it. But I used to live right near a dog park and everybody had dogs, including us. So it was just she got so used to barking.
Yeah.
It just wasn't even an issue.
I mean, maybe just while we were chatting, I was thinking, well, how would you address it if it was somebody else's dog? Maybe you just simply ask the question on radio and hope that your neighbour's listening.
Yeah, good one. Good one. Did not think of that. Gary's in Moggle. Hello.
Hi, Sally. How are you?
Yeah, good. What's your question?
Well, Sam, I've got a chocolate lab and I've got a Labrador cross, and every probably two or three weeks or once a week, I give them a can of sardines.
Yep.
In there mixed with their food, and it's in oil. And I heard that you're not supposed to give them oil. Is that right?
Well, you can give them oil, Gary. It is a good question because, I mean, there are, generally speaking, we'd say to someone, try to avoid feeding them, you know, a large amount of oil all at once.
Sure.
It could precipitate pancreatitis in an individual, right? But if that hasn't caused any kind of gastrointestinal issue for your dogs, I think it'll be fine, provided that they're not overweight. Because remember, oil will contribute a lot to the caloric load. So if your dogs are lean and they've always been lean and you're not having an issue in that department and there's no, you don't see any diarrhea or anything like that from the oil, from the, you know, the tuna or whatever, then go ahead and do it. It's just for those cases, I think, where we are concerned about pancreatitis, those really fatty foods, they can actually bring it on. So we want to avoid that.
I don't know if lean Labradors exist.
Digby's pretty lean.
Is he?
Yeah. We've kept him lean because he's got arthritis.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference to the load.
Are your Labradors lean?
My chocolate's quite lean in the back. His instead is quite defined, his stomach and that.
Huh?
Okay.
Recessed in,
You're a miracle worker, Gary. Good on you.
Yeah, I know.
They will eat anything, won't they, Gary? You know, they're funny. I just love their enthusiasm for food. I mean, once I actually had someone say to me, what sort of breed is he? And I'm thinking to myself, Digby is a stock standard Labrador.
Yeah.
But the perception of what a Labrador should look like these days is kind of log, you know, with legs sticking off.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Good on you, Gary. Thank you so
much. Thanks, Sally.
We might have to let you go, Sam, but thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yet again, and we'll see you in about 6 weeks.
Look forward to it.
Sam Jones from My Local Vet on 612 ABC Brisbane and ABC Queensland.